shone under their brows. The rest of their bodies matched, with narrow shoulders and slender arms and legs. Each was more fair and noble than any human Aragorn had seen, albeit in a rarefied, exotic manner. "Whoever thought I would get to visit the elves' homeland?" Aragorn asked himself. He grinned and leaned against the corner of a hut, drowsy with the fire's warmth. Above him, Saphira's dancing blue eyes tracked the elves with unwavering precision.
"More magic is in this race," she finally remarked, "than either humans or dwarves. They do not feel as if they come from the earth or the stone, but rather from another realm, half in, half out, like reflections seen through water."
"They certainly are graceful," he said. The elves moved like dancers, their every action smooth and lithe. Brom had told Aragorn that it was rude for someone to speak with their mind to a rider's dragon without permission, and the elves adhered to that custom, voicing aloud their comments to Saphira, who would then answer the elves directly. Saphira usually refrained from touching the thoughts of humans and dwarves, and allowed Aragorn to relay her words, since few members of those races had the training to guard their minds if they wished for privacy. It also seemed an imposition to use such an intimate form of contact for casual exchanges. The elves had no such inhibitions, though. They welcomed Saphira into their minds, reveling in her presence. At last, the food was ready and served on carved plates that felt like dense bone, although wood grain wandered through the flowers and vines decorating the rim. Aragorn was also supplied with a flagon of gooseberry wine, made of the same unusual material, with a sculpted dragon wrapped around its stem. As they ate, Lefain produced a set of reed pipes and began to play a flowing melody, his fingers running along the various holes. Soon the tallest, silver-haired elf, Nari, raised his voice and sang. "Oh, the day is done, the stars are bright, the leaves are still, the moon is white. Laugh at woe and laugh at foe, Manoa's scion now is safe this night. A forest child we lost to strife, a sylvan daughter caught by life. Freed of fear and freed of flame, she tore a rider from the shadows rife. Again the dragons rise on wing, and we avenge their suffering. Strong of blade and strong of arm, the time is ripe for us to kill a king. Oh, the wind is soft, the river deep, the trees are tall, the birds do sleep. Laugh at woe and laugh at foe. The hour has arrived for joy to reap." When Nari finished, Aragorn released his pent-up breath. He had never heard such a voice before. It felt as if the elf had revealed his essence, his very soul. "That was beautiful, Nari Vodur." "A rough composition, Arjutlam," demurred Nari, "but I thank you nevertheless." Thorv grunted.
"Very pretty, Master Elf. However, there are matters more serious than reciting verse that we must attend to. Are we to accompany Aragorn, Father?"
"No," said Arya quickly, drawing looks from the other elves. "You may return home in the morning. We will assure that Aragorn reaches Ellesmira." Thorv dipped his head.
"Then our task is complete."
As Aragorn lay on the bedding the elves had arranged for him, he strained his ears to catch Arya's speech, which drifted from one of the huts. Though she used many unfamiliar words in the ancient language, he deduced that she was explaining to their hosts how she had lost Saphira's egg and the events since. A long silence followed after she stopped. Then an elf said,
"It is good that you have returned, Arya Drotningu. Islan Zadi was sorely wounded by grief when you were captured and the egg was stolen, and by Urgals no less. She was and is sick at heart."
"Harsh, Edurna, harsh," chided another.
"Fergar are small, but they have sharp ears, and I am sure these will report to Hrothgar."
Then their voices dropped, and Aragorn could discern no more from the murmur of voices, which melded into the whisper of leaves as he drifted to sleep, the elf's song repeating endlessly through his dreams. The scent of flowers was heavy in the air when Aragorn woke to behold a sun-drenched Duweldenvarden. Above him marched a mottled panoply of drifting leaves, supported by the thick trunks that buried themselves in the dry, bare ground. Only moss, lichen, and a few low shrubs survived in the pervasive green shade. The scarcity of underbrush made it possible to see for great distances between the knotted pillars and to walk about freely beneath the dappled ceiling. Rolling to his feet, Aragorn found Thorv and his guards packed and ready to leave. Auric's donkey was tied behind Exvar's steed. Aragorn approached Thorv and said, "Thank you, all of you, for protecting me and Saphira. Please convey our gratitude to Undin." Thorv pressed his fist to his chest.
"I will carry your words."
He hesitated and looked back at the huts.
"Elves are a queer race, full of light and dark. In the morning they drink with you, in the evening they stab you. Keep thine back to a wall, Shadeslayer. Capricious they are."
"I will remember that."
Thorv gestured toward the river. "They plan to travel up Eldor Lake in boats. What will you do with thine horse? We could return him to Tarnag with us, and from there to Trondheim."
"Boats!" cried Aragorn with dismay. He had always planned to bring Snowfire to Ellesmere. It was convenient to have a horse whenever Saphira was away, or in places too confined for her bulk. He fingered the sparse bristles along his jaw. "That is a kind offer. Will you make sure Snowfire is well cared for? I couldn't bear it if anything were to happen to him."
"On mine honour," pledged Thorv, "you will return to find him fat and sleek."
Aragorn fetched Snowfire and transferred the stallion, his saddle and his grooming supplies into Thorv's care. He bade each of the warriors farewell, then he, Saphira and Auric watched the dwarves ride back along the trail they had arrived on. Returning to the huts, Aragorn and the remainder of his party followed the elves to a thicket on the edge of the Edda River. There, docked on either side of a boulder, were two white canoes with vines carved along their sides. Aragorn boarded the nearest boat and stowed his pack beneath his feet. He was amazed by how light the craft was. He could have lifted it with a single hand. Even more astounding, the hulls appeared to be composed of birch-bark panels melded into a seamless whole. Curious, he touched the side. The bark was hard and taut, like stretched parchment, and cool from its contact with the water. He rapped it with a knuckle. The fibrous shell reverberated like a muted drum. "Are all your boats made this way?" he asked.
"All except the very largest," answered Nari, seating himself at the prow of Aragorn's vessel. "For those we sing the finest cedar and oak into shape."
Before Aragorn could ask what he meant, Auric joined their canoe, while Arya and Lyfane appropriated the second one. Arya turned to Edurne and Seldin, who stood on the bank, and said, "Guard this way so that none may follow us, and tell no one of our presence. The queen must be the first to know. I will send reinforcements as soon as we reach Sealthrim."
"Arya Drottningu."
"May the stars watch over you," she answered.
Bending forward, Nari and Lyfane drew spiked poles 10 feet long from inside the boats and began propelling the vessels upstream. Saphira slid into the water behind them and clawed her way along the riverbed until they were level. When Aragorn looked at her, she winked lazily, then submerged, forcing the river to swell into a mound over her jagged back. The elves laughed as she did so and made many compliments about her size and strength. After an hour, they reached Eldor Lake, which was rough with small, jagged waves. Birds and flies swarmed by a wall of trees edging the western shore, while the eastern shore sloped up into the plains. On that side meandered hundreds of deer. Once they escaped the river's current, Nari and Lyfane stowed their poles, then distributed leaf-bladed paddles. Auric and Arya already knew how to steer a boat, but Nari had to explain the process to Aragorn.
We turn toward whichever side you paddle on, said the elf. So if I paddle on the right and Auric paddles on the left, then you must paddle first on one side, then the other, else we will drift off course.
In the daylight, Nari's hair shimmered like the finest wire, each strand a fiery line. Aragorn soon mastered the ability, and as the motion became habitual, his mind was free to daydream. Thus he floated up the cool lake, lost in the fantastic worlds hidden behind his eyes. When he paused to rest his arms, he once again pulled Auric's puzzle ring from his belt and struggled to arrange the obstinate gold bands into the correct pattern. Nari noticed what he was doing.
May I see that ring?
Aragorn passed it to the elf, who turned his back. For a few moments Aragorn and Auric manoeuvred the canoe alone as Nari picked at the entwined bands. Then, with a pleased exclamation, Nari raised his hand, and the completed ring flashed on his middle finger.
A delightful riddle, said Nari.
He slipped off the ring and shook it, so that it was in its original state when he returned it to Aragorn.
How did you solve it?
Demanded Aragorn, dismayed and envious that Nari had been able to master the puzzle so easily.
Wait, don't tell me. I want to figure it out on my own.
Of course, said Nari, smiling.
Wounds of the Past. For 3.5 days, the citizens of Carvajal discussed the latest attack, the tragedy of young Elmund's death, and what could possibly be done to escape their thrice-blasted situation. The debate raged with bitter fury through every room of every home. In the space of a word, friends turned against friends, husbands against wives, children against parents, only to reconcile moments later in their frantic attempt to discover a means of survival. Some said that since Carvajal was doomed anyway, they might as well kill the Razak and remaining soldiers so as to at least have their vengeance. Others said that if Carvajal really was doomed, then the only logical course was to surrender and trust themselves to the king's mercy, even if it did mean torture and death and enslavement for everyone else. And still others sided with neither opinion, but rather descended into a sullen black anger directed at everyone who had brought about this calamity. Many did their best to hide their panic in the depths of a tankard. The Razak themselves had apparently realized that with 11 soldiers dead, they no longer had a large enough force to attack Carvajal, and thus had retreated farther down the road, where they were content to post sentinels across Palancar Valley and wait.
"Wait for flea-bitten troops from Sionon or Gilead, if you ask me,"
Loring said at one meeting. Roran listened to that and more, kept his own counsel, and silently judged the various schemes. They all seemed dangerously risky. Roran still had not told Sloane that he and Katrina were engaged. He knew it was foolish to wait, but he feared how the butcher would react when he learned that Roran and Katrina had flouted tradition, and in doing so, undermined Sloane's authority. Besides, there was plenty of work to divert Roran's attention. He convinced himself that strengthening the fortifications around Carvajal was his most important task at the moment. Getting people to help was easier than Roran anticipated. After the last fight, the villagers were more apt to listen and to obey him, that is, those who did not blame him for causing their predicament. He was mystified by his new authority until he realized that it was the result of the awe, respect, and perhaps even fear his kills had elicited. They called him Stronghammer. Roran Stronghammer. The name pleased him. As night engulfed the valley, Roran leaned against a corner of Horst's dining room, his eyes closed. Conversation flowed from the men and women seated around the candlelit table. Kiselt was in the middle of explaining the state of Carvajal's supplies.
"We won't starve," he concluded, "but if we can't tend to our fields and our flocks soon, we might as well cut our own throats before next winter. It would be a kinder fate."
Horst scowled.
"Dog tripe."
"Dog tripe or not," said Gertrude, "I doubt we'll have a chance to find out. We outnumbered the soldiers 10-1 when they arrived. They lost 11 men, we lost 12, and I'm caring for another 9 wounded. What happens, Horst, when they outnumber us 10 to 1?
We will give the bards a reason to remember our names, retorted the smith.
Gertrude shook her head sadly. Loring banged a fist on the table.
And I say it's our turn to strike before we are outnumbered. All we need are a few men, shields and spears, and we can wipe out their infestation. It could be done tonight.
Roran shifted restlessly. He had heard all this before, and like before, Loring's proposal ignited an argument that consumed the group. After an hour, the debate still showed no sign of being resolved, nor had any new ideas been presented, except for Thane's suggestion that Gedric should go tan his own hide, which nearly resulted in a fistfight. Finally, when the conversation lulled, Roran limped to the table as quickly as his injured calf would allow.
I have something to say.
For him, it was the equivalent of stepping on a long thorn and then yanking it out without stopping to consider the pain. It had to be done, and the faster the better. All eyes, hard, soft, angry, kind, indifferent, and curious, turned to him, and Roran took a deep breath.
Indecision will kill us just as surely as a sword or an arrow.
Orval rolled his eyes, but the rest still listened.
I don't know if we should attack or flee.
Where? Snorted Kizzelt.
But I do know one thing. Our children, our mothers and our infirm must be protected from danger. The Razak have barred us from Corley and the other farms down the valley. So what? We know this land better than any in Alagazia. And there is a place where our loved ones will be safe.
The spine. Roran winced as a barrage of outraged voices assaulted him. Sloane was the loudest, shouting,
I'll be hanged before I set foot in those cursed mountains. Roran, said Horst, overriding the commotion, you of all people should know that the spine is too dangerous. It's where Aragorn found the stone that brought the Razak. The mountains are cold and filled with wolves, bears and other monsters. Why even mention them?
To keep Katrina safe, Roran wanted to scream.
Instead, he said, because no matter how many soldiers the Razak summon, they will never dare enter the spine. Not after Galbatorix lost half his army in it.
That was a long time ago, said Morn doubtfully.
Roran jumped on his statement.
And the stories have grown all the more frightening in the telling. A trail already exists to the top of Igualda Falls. All we have to do is send the children and others up there. They'll only be on the fringe of the mountains, but they'll still be safe. If Carvajal is taken, they can wait until the soldiers leave, then find refuge in Therensford.
It is too dangerous, growled Sloane.
The butcher gripped the edge of the table so hard that the tips of his fingers turned white.
The cold, the beasts. No sane man would send his family among those.
But, Roran faltered, put off balance by Sloane's response. Though he knew the butcher hated the spine more than most, because his wife had plummeted to her death from the cliffs beside Igualda Falls, he had hoped that Sloane's rabid desire to protect Katrina would be strong enough to overcome his aversion. Roran now understood he would have to win over Sloane just like everyone else. Adopting a placating tone, Roran said,
It's not that bad. The snow is already melting off the peaks. It's no colder in the spine than it was down here a few months ago, and I doubt that wolves or bears would bother such a large group.
Sloane grimaced, twisting his lips up over his teeth, and shook his head.
You will find nothing but death in the spine.
The others seemed to agree, which only strengthened Roran's determination, for he was convinced that Katrina would die unless he could sway them. He scanned the long oval of faces, searching for a sympathetic expression.
Delwyn, I know it's cruel of me to say it, but if Elmund hadn't been in Carvajal, he would still be alive. Surely you must agree that this is the right thing to do. You have an opportunity to save other parents from your suffering.
No one responded.
And Birgit.
Roran dragged himself toward her, clutching the backs of chairs to keep himself from falling.
Do you want Nolfavrel to share his father's fate? He has to leave.
Can't you see? That is the only way he'll be safe. Though Roran did his best to fight it, he could feel tears flood his eyes.
It's for the children!
He shouted angrily. The room was silent as Roran stared at the wood beneath his hands, struggling to control himself. Delwyn was the first to stir.
I will never leave Carvajal so long as my son's killers remain here. However, he paused, then continued with painful slowness, I cannot deny the truth of your words. The children must be protected.
As I said from the beginning, declared Tara. Then Baldur spoke.
Roran is right. We can't allow ourselves to be blinded by fear. Most of us have climbed to the top of the falls at one time or another. It's safe enough.
I too, Birgit finally added, must agree. Horst nodded.
I would rather not do it, but considering the circumstances, I don't think we have any other choice.
After a minute, the various men and women began to reluctantly acquiesce to the proposal.
Nonsense!
Exploded Sloane. He stood and stabbed an accusing finger at Roran.
How will they get enough food to wait for weeks on end? They can't carry it. How will they stay warm? If they light fires, they'll be seen. How? If they don't starve, they'll freeze. If they don't freeze, they'll be eaten. If they're not eaten, who knows? They may fall.
Roran spread his hands.
If we all help, they will have plenty of food. Fire won't be a problem if they move farther back into the forest, which they must anyway, since there isn't room to camp right by the falls. Excuses, justifications. What would you have us do, Sloane?
Eyeing him with curiosity. Sloane laughed bitterly.
Not this. Then what? It doesn't matter. Only this is the wrong choice.
You don't have to participate, pointed out Horst.
Nor will I, said the butcher.
Proceed if you want, but neither I nor my blood shall enter the spine while I still have marrow in my bones.
He grabbed his cap and left with a venomous glare at Roran, who returned the scowl in kind. As Roran saw it, Sloane was endangering Katrina through his own pig-headed stubbornness.
If he can't bring himself to accept the spine as a place of refuge, decided Roran, then he's become my enemy, and I have to take matters into my own hands.
Horst leaned forward on his elbows and interlaced his thick fingers.
So, if we are going to use Roran's plan, what preparations will be needed?
The group exchanged wary glances, then gradually began to discuss the topic. Roran waited until he was convinced that he had achieved his goal before slipping out of the dining room. Loping through the dusky village, he searched for Sloane along the inner perimeter of the tree wall. Eventually, he spotted the butcher hunched underneath a torch, his shield clasped around his knees. Roran spun around on one foot and ran to Sloane's shop, where he hurried to the kitchen in the back. Katrina paused in the middle of setting their table and stared at him with amazement.
Roran, why are you here? Did you tell father?
No. He came forward and took her arm, savouring the touch. Just being in the same room with her filled him with joy.
I have a great favour to ask of you. It's been decided to send the children and a few others into the spine above Igualda Falls.
Katrina gasped.
I want you to accompany them.
With a shocked expression, Katrina pulled free of his grasp and turned to the open fireplace, where she hugged herself and stared at the bed of throbbing embers. For a long time she said nothing. Then,
Father forbade me to go near the falls after Mother died. Album's farm is the closest I've been to the spine in over 10 years.
She shivered, and her voice grew accusing.
How can you suggest that I abandon both you and my father? This is my home as much as yours. And why should I leave when Elaine, Tara, and Birgit will remain? Katrina, please.
He tentatively put his hands on her shoulders.
The Razak are here for me, and I would not have you harmed because of that. As long as you're in danger, I can't concentrate on what has to be done, defending Carvajal. Who would respect me for fleeing like a coward?
She lifted her chin.
I would be ashamed to stand before the women of Carvajal and call myself your wife. Coward?
There is no cowardice in guarding and protecting the children in the spine. If anything, it requires greater courage to enter the mountains than to stay.
What horror is this?
Whispered Katrina. She twisted in his arms, eyes shining and mouth set firmly.
The man who would be my husband no longer wants me by his side.
He shook his head.
That's not true. It is true. What if you are killed while I'm gone? Don't say... No, Carvajal has little hope of survival, and if we must die, I would rather die together than huddle in the spine without life or heart. Let those with children tend to their own, as will I.
A tear rolled down her cheek. Gratitude and wonder surged through Roran at the strength of her devotion. He looked deep into her eyes. It is for love that I would have you go. I know how you feel. I know that this is the hardest sacrifice either of us could make, and I ask it of you now. Katrina shuddered, her entire body rigid, her white hands clenched around her muslin sash.
If I do this, she said with a shaky voice, you must promise me here and now that you will never make such a request again. You must promise that even if we faced Galbatorix himself and only one of us could escape, you would not ask me to leave.
Roran looked at her helplessly.
I can't. Then how can you expect me to do what you won't? She cried. That is my price, and neither gold nor jewels nor pretty words can replace your oath. If you don't care enough for me to make your own sacrifice, Roran Stronghammer, then be gone, and I never wish to see your face again.
I cannot lose her. Though it pained him almost beyond endurance, he bowed his head and said, You have my word. Katrina nodded and sank into a chair, her back stiff and upright, and blotted her tears on the cuff of her sleeve. In a quiet voice, she said,
Father will hate me for going.
How will you tell him?
I won't, she said defiantly. He would never let me enter the spine. But he has to realize that this is my decision. Anyway, he won't dare pursue me into the mountains. He fears them more than death itself.
He may fear losing you even more.
We shall see. If, when the time comes to return, I expect you to have already spoken to him about our engagement. That should give him enough time to reconcile himself to the fact.
Roran found himself nodding in agreement, all the while thinking that they would be lucky if events worked out so well. Wounds of the Present. When dawn arrived, Roran woke and lay staring at the whitewashed ceiling while he listened to the slow rasp of his own breathing. After a minute, he rolled off the bed, dressed, and proceeded to the kitchen, where he procured a chunk of bread, smeared it with soft cheese, then stepped out onto the front porch to eat and admire the sunrise. His tranquillity was soon disrupted when a herd of unruly children dashed through the garden of a nearby house, shrieking with delight at their game of catch the cat, followed by a number of adults intent on snaring their respective charges. Roran watched the cacophonous parade vanish around a corner, then placed the last of the bread in his mouth and returned to the kitchen, which had filled with the rest of the household. Elaine greeted him.
Good morning, Roran.
She pushed open the window shutters and gazed up at the sky.
It looks like it may rain again.
The more the better, asserted Horst. It'll help keep us hidden while we climb Narnmore Mountain.
Us? Inquired Roran.
He sat at the table beside Albrecht, who was rubbing the sleep from his eyes. Horst nodded.
Sloane was right about the food and supplies. We have to help carry them up the falls, or else there won't be enough.
Will there still be men to defend Carvajal?
Of course, of course.
Once they all had breakfast, Roran helped Baldur and Albrecht wrap spare food, blankets and supplies into three large bundles that they slung across their shoulders and hauled to the north end of the village. Roran's calf pained him, but not unbearably. Along the way they met the three brothers, Darman, Larn and Hammond, who were similarly burdened. Just inside the trench that circumnavigated the houses, Roran and his companions found a large gathering of children, parents and grandparents, all busy organizing for the expedition. Several families had volunteered their donkeys to carry goods and the younger children. The animals were picketed in an impatient, braying line that added to the overall confusion. Roran set his bundle on the ground and scanned the group. He saw Svart, Ivor's uncle, and at nearly 60, the oldest man in Carvajal, seated on a bale of clothes, teasing a baby with the tip of his long white beard. Nolfrevrel, who was guarded over by Birgit, Felder, Nola, Kalitha, and a number of other mothers with worried expressions, and a great many reluctant people, both men and women. Roran also saw Katrina among the crowd. She glanced up from a knot she was tying on a pack and smiled at him, then returned to her task. Since no one seemed to be in charge, Roran did his best to sort out the chaos by overseeing the arranging and packaging of the various supplies. He discovered a shortage of water skins, but when he asked for more, he ended up with 13 too many. Delays such as those consumed the early morning hours. In the middle of discussing with Loring the possible need for extra shoes, Roran stopped as he noticed Sloane standing at the entrance to an alleyway. The butcher surveyed the mass of activity before him. Contempt cut into the lines along his downturned mouth. His sneer hardened into enraged incredulity as he spotted Katrina, who had shouldered her pack, removing any possibility that she was there only to help. A vein throbbed down the middle of Sloane's forehead. Roran hurried toward Katrina, but Sloane reached her first. He grabbed the top of the pack and shook it violently, shouting, "Who made you do this?" Katrina said something about the children and tried to pull free, but Sloane yanked at the pack, twisting her arms as the straps slid off her shoulders, and threw it on the ground so that the contents scattered. Still shouting, Sloane grabbed Katrina's arm and began to drag her away. She dug in her heels and fought, her copper hair swirling over her face like a dust storm. Furious, Roran threw himself at Sloane and tore him from Katrina, shoving the butcher in the chest so that he stumbled backwards several yards. "Stop! I'm the one who wanted her to go!" Sloane glared at Roran and snarled, "You have no right! I have every right!" Roran looked at the ring of spectators who had gathered around and then declared so that all could hear, "Katrina and I are engaged to be married, and I would not have my future wife treated so." For the first time that day, the villagers fell completely silent. Even the donkeys were quiet. Surprise and a deep, inconsolable pain sprang into Sloane's vulnerable face, along with the glimmer of tears. For a moment, Roran felt sympathy for him. Then a series of contortions distorted Sloane's visage, each more extreme than the last, until his skin turned beet red. He cursed and said, "You two-faced coward! How could you look me in the eye and speak to me like an honest man while at the same time courting my daughter without permission? I dealt with you in good faith, and here I find you plundering my house while my back is turned." "I had hoped to do this properly," said Roran. "But events have conspired against me. It was never my intention to cause you grief. Even though this hasn't gone the way either of us wanted, I still want your blessing, if you are willing."
"I would rather have a maggot-riddled pig for a son than you. You have no farm, you have no family, and you will have naught to do with my daughter."
The butcher cursed again.
"And she'll have naught to do with the spine."
Sloane reached for Katrina, but Roran blocked the way, his face as hard as his clenched fists. Only a hand's breadth apart, they stared directly at each other, trembling from the strength of their emotions. Sloane's red-rimmed eyes shone with manic intensity.
"Katrina, come here," Sloane commanded.
Roran withdrew from Sloane, so that the three of them formed a triangle and looked at Katrina. Tears streamed down her face as she glanced between him and her father. She stepped forward, hesitated, then with a long, anguished cry, tore at her hair in a frenzy of indecision.
"Katrina!"
exclaimed Sloane with a burr of fear. "Katrina," murmured Roran. At the sound of his voice, Katrina's tears ceased, and she stood straight and tall with a calm expression. She said,
"I'm sorry, father, but I have decided to marry Roran,"
and stepped to his side. Sloane turned bone white. He bit his lip so hard that a bead of ruby blood appeared. "You can't leave me. You're my daughter." He lunged at her with crooked hands. In that instant, Roran bellowed and struck the butcher with all his strength, knocking him sprawling in the dirt before the entire village. Sloane rose slowly, his face and neck flushed with humiliation. When he saw Katrina again, the butcher seemed to crumple inward, losing height and stature, until Roran felt as if he were looking at a spectre of the original man. In a low whisper, he said, "It is always so. Those closest to the heart cause the most pain. Thou will have no dowry from me, snake, nor your mother's inheritance." Weeping bitterly, Sloane turned and fled toward his shop. Katrina leaned against Roran, and he put an arm around her. Together they clung to each other as people crowded against them, offering condolences, advice, congratulations, and disapproval. Despite the commotion, Roran was aware of nothing but the woman whom he held, and who held him. Just then Elaine bustled up as fast as her pregnancy would allow.
"Oh, you poor dear,"
she cried, and embraced Katrina, drawing her from Roran's arms.
"Is it true you are engaged?"
Katrina nodded and smiled, then erupted into hysterical tears against Elaine's shoulder.
There now."
Elaine cradled Katrina gently, petting her and trying to soothe her, but without avail. Every time Roran thought she was about to recover, Katrina began to cry with renewed intensity. Finally, Elaine peered over Katrina's quaking shoulder and said, "I'm taking her back to the house."
"I'll come."
"No, you won't," retorted Elaine. "She needs time to calm down, and you have work to do. Do you want my advice?" Roran nodded dumbly. "Stay away until evening. I guarantee that she will be as right as rain by then. She can join the others tomorrow." Without waiting for his response, Elaine escorted the sobbing Katrina away from the wall of sharpened trees. Roran stood with his hands hanging limply by his sides, feeling dazed and helpless.
What have we done?
He regretted that he had not revealed their engagement to Sloane sooner. He regretted that he and Sloane could not work together to shield Katrina from the Empire. And he regretted that Katrina had been forced to relinquish her only family for him. He was now doubly responsible for her welfare. They had no choice but to get married.
"I've made a terrible mess of this."
He sighed and clenched his fist, wincing as his bruised knuckles stretched. "How are you?" asked Baldur, coming alongside him. Roran forced a smile. "It didn't turn out quite how I hoped. Sloane's beyond reason when it comes to the spine. And Katrina."
"That too.
Roran fell silent as Loring stopped before them.
"That was a blasted fool thing to do,"
growled the shoemaker, wrinkling his nose. Then he stuck out his chin, grinned and bared his stumps of teeth.
"But I hope you and the girl have the best of luck."
He shook his head.
"You're going to need it, Stronghammer."
"We're all going to need it," snapped Thane as he walked past.
Loring waved a hand.
"Bah, sourpuss. Listen, Roran, I've lived in Carvajal for many, many years, and in my experience, it's better that this happened now, instead of when we're all warm and cosy."
Baldur nodded, but Roran asked, "Why so?"
"Isn't it obvious? Normally you and Katrina would be the meat of gossip for the next 9 months."
Loring put a finger on the side of his nose.
"Ah, oh, but this way you'll soon be forgotten amid everything else that's going on, and then the two of you might even have some peace."
Roran frowned. "I'd rather be talked about than have those desecrators camped on the road."
"So would we all. Still, it's something to be grateful for. And we all need something to be grateful for, especially once you're married."
Loring cackled and pointed at Roran.
"Your face just turned purple, boy."
Roran grunted and set about gathering Katrina's possessions off the ground. As he did, he was interrupted by comments from whoever happened to be nearby, none of which helped to settle his nerves.
"Rotgut,"
he muttered to himself after a particularly invidious remark. Although the expedition into the spine was delayed by the unusual scene the villagers had just witnessed, it was only slightly after mid-morning when the caravan of people and donkeys began to ascend the bare trail scratched into the side of Narnmoor Mountain to the crest of the Igawalda Falls. It was a steep climb and had to be taken slowly, on account of the children and the size of the burdens everyone carried. Roran spent most of his time caught behind Kalitha, Thane's wife, and her five children. He did not mind, as it gave him an opportunity to indulge his injured calf and to consider recent events at length. He was disturbed by his confrontation with Sloane. At least, he consoled himself, Katrina won't remain in Carverhall much longer. For Roran was convinced in his heart of hearts that the village would soon be defeated. It was a sobering yet unavoidable realization. He paused to rest 3/4 of the way up the mountain and leaned against a tree as he admired the elevated view of Palancar Valley. He tried to spot the Razak's camp, which he knew was just to the left of the Anora River and the road south, but was unable to discern even a wisp of smoke. Roran heard the roar of the Igawalda Falls long before they came into sight. The falls appeared for all the world like a great snowy mane that billowed and drifted off Narnmoor's craggy head to the valley floor a half mile below. The massive stream curved in several directions as it fell, the result of different layers of wind. Past the slate ledge where the Anora River became airborne, down a glen filled with thimbleberries, and then finally into a large clearing guarded on one side by a pile of boulders, Roran found that those at the head of the procession had already begun setting up camp. The forest rang with the children's shouts and cries. Removing his pack, Roran untied an axe from the top, then set about clearing the underbrush from the site along with several other men. When they finished, they began chopping down enough trees to encircle the camp. The aroma of pine sap filled the air. Roran worked quickly, the wood chips flying in unison with his rhythmic swings. By the time the fortifications were complete, the camp had already been erected, with 17 wool tents, 4 small cook fires, and glum expressions from people and donkeys alike. No one wanted to leave, and no one wanted to stay. Roran surveyed the assortment of boys and old men clutching spears and thought, too much experience and too little. The grandfathers know how to deal with bears and the like, but will the grandsons have the strength to actually do it? Then he noticed the hard glint in the women's eyes, and realized that while they might hold a babe or be busy tending a scraped arm, their own shields and spears were never far from reach. Roran smiled. Perhaps we still have hope. He saw Nol Favrell sitting alone on a log, staring back toward Palancar Valley, and joined the boy, who looked at him seriously. Are you leaving soon? Asked Nol Favrell. Roran nodded, impressed by his poise and determination. You will do your best, won't you, to kill the Razak and avenge my father? I would do it, except that Mama says I must guard my brothers and sisters. I'll bring you their heads myself if I can, promised Roran. The boy's chin trembled. That is good. Nol Favrell. Roran paused as he searched for the right words. You are the only one here besides me who has killed a man. It doesn't mean that we are better or worse than anyone else, but it means that I can trust you to fight well if you are attacked. When Katrina comes here tomorrow, will you make sure that she's well protected? Nol Favrell's chest swelled with pride. I'll guard her wherever she goes. Then he looked regretful. That is, when I don't have to look after... Roran understood. Oh, your family comes first. But maybe Katrina can stay in the tent with your brothers and sisters. Yes, said Nol Favrell slowly. Yes, I think that would work. You can rely on me. Thank you. Roran clapped him on the shoulder. He could have asked an older and more capable person, but the adults were too busy with their own responsibilities to defend Katrina as he hoped. Nol Favrell, however, would have the opportunity and inclination to assure that she remained safe. He can hold my place while we are apart. Roran stood as Birgit approached. Eyeing him flatly, she said, Come, it is time. Then she hugged her son, and continued toward the falls with Roran and the other villagers who were returning to Carvajal. Behind them, everyone in the small camp clustered against the fell trees and stared forlornly out through their wooden bars. His enemy's face. As Roran proceeded about his work throughout the rest of the day, he felt Carvajal's emptiness deep inside. It was as if part of himself had been extracted and hidden in the spine, and with the children gone, the village now felt like an armed camp. The change seemed to have made everyone grim and grave. When the sun finally sank into the waiting teeth of the spine, Roran climbed the hill to Horst's house. He stopped before the front door and placed a hand on the knob, but remained there, unable to enter. "Why does this frighten me as much as fighting?" In the end, he forsook the front door entirely and went to the side of the house, where he slipped into the kitchen and, to his dismay, saw Elaine knitting on one side of the table, speaking to Katrina, who was opposite her. They both turned toward him, and Roran blurted, "Are you all right?" Katrina came to his side.
"I'm fine."
She smiled softly.
"It just was a terrible shock when Father... when..."
She ducked her head for a moment.
"Elaine has been wonderfully kind to me. She agreed to lend me Baldur's room for the night."
"I'm glad you are better," said Roran. He hugged her, trying to convey all of his love and adoration through that simple touch. Elaine wrapped up her knitting.
"Come now, the sun has set, and it's time you were off to bed, Katrina."
Roran reluctantly let go of Katrina, who kissed him on the cheek and said,
"I'll see you in the morning."
He started to follow her out, but stopped when Elaine said, with a barbed tone, "Roran?" Her delicate face was hard and stern.
"Yes?"
Elaine waited until they heard the creak of stairs that indicated Katrina was out of earshot.
"I hope that you meant every promise you gave that girl, because if you didn't, I'll call an assembly and have you exiled within a week." Roran was dumbfounded. "Of course I meant them. I love her." "Katrina just surrendered everything she owned or cared about for you."
Elaine stared up at him with unwavering eyes.
"I've seen men who throw their affection at young maids like grain tossed at chickens. The maids sigh and weep and believe that they are special. Yet for the man it's only a trifling amusement. You have always been honourable, Roran. But one's loins can turn even the most sensible person into a prancing booby or a sly, wicked fox. Are you one? For Katrina requires neither a fool, a trickster, nor even love. What she requires above all else is a man who will provide for her. If you abandon her, she will be the meanest person in Carvajal, forced to live off her friends, our first and only beggar. By the blood in my veins, I won't let that happen."
"Nor would I," protested Roran. "I would have to be heartless, or worse, to do so."
Elaine jerked her chin.
"Exactly. Don't forget that you intend to marry a woman who has lost both her dowry and her mother's inheritance. Do you understand what it means for Katrina to lose her inheritance? She has no silver, no linens, no lace, nor any of the things needed for a well-run home. Such items are all we own, passed from mother to daughter since the day we first settled Alagasia. They determine our worth. A woman without her inheritance is like...
is like a man without a farm or a trade," said Roran.
"Just so. It was cruel of Sloane to deny Katrina her inheritance, but that can't be helped now. Both you and she have no money or resources. Life is difficult enough without that added hardship. You'll be starting from nothing and with nothing. Does the prospect frighten you or seem unbearable? So I ask you once again, and don't lie, or the two of you will regret it for the rest of your lives. Will you care for her without grudge or resentment?"
"Yes." Elaine sighed, and filled two earthen cups with cider from a jug hanging among the rafters. She handed one to Roran as she seated herself back at the table.
"Then I suggest that you devote yourself to replacing Katrina's home and inheritance, so that she and any daughters you may have can stand without shame among the wives of Carvajal."
Roran sipped the cool cider.
"If we live that long..."
Aye. She brushed back a strand of her blonde hair and shook her head. You've chosen a hard path, Roran. I had to make sure that Katrina would leave Carverhall. Elaine lifted an eyebrow. So that was it. Well, I won't argue about it. But why on earth didn't you speak to Sloane about your engagement before this morning? When Horst asked my father, he gave our family 12 sheep, a sow, and 8 pairs of wrought iron candlesticks before he even knew if my parents would agree. That's how it should be done. Surely you could have thought of a better strategy than striking your father-in-law to be. A painful laugh escaped Roran. I could have, but it never seemed the right time with all the attacks. The Razak haven't attacked for almost 6 days now. He scowled. No, but it was... Oh, I don't know. He banged his fist on the table with frustration. Elaine put down her cup and wrapped her tiny hands around his. If you can mend this rift between you and Sloane now, before years of resentment accumulate, your life with Katrina will be much, much easier. Tomorrow morning you should go to his house and beg his forgiveness. I won't beg, not to him. Roran, listen to me. It's worth a month of begging to have peace in your family. I know from experience. Strife does naught but make you miserable. Sloane hates the spine. He'll have nothing to do with me. You have to try, though, said Elaine earnestly. Even if he spurns your apology, at least you can't be blamed for not making the effort. If you love Katrina, then swallow your pride and do what's right for her. Don't make her suffer for your mistake. She finished her cider, used a tin hat to snuff the candles, and left Roran sitting alone in the dark. Several minutes elapsed before Roran could bring himself to stir. He stretched out an arm and traced along the counter's edge until he felt the doorway, then proceeded upstairs, all the while running the tips of his fingers over the carved walls to keep his balance. In his room, he disrobed and threw himself lengthwise on the bed. Wrapping his arms around his wool-stuffed pillow, Roran listened to the faint sounds that drifted through the house at night. The scrabble of a mouse in the attic and its intermittent squeaks, the groan of wood beams cooling in the night, the whisper and caress of wind at the lintel of his window, and the rustle of slippers in the hall outside his room. He watched as the latch above the doorknob was pulled free of its hook. Then the door inched forward with a rasp of protest. It paused. A dark form slipped inside. The door closed, and Roran felt a curtain of hair brush his face, along with lips like rose petals. He sighed. Katrina. A thunderclap tore Roran from sleep. Light flared on his face as he struggled to regain awareness, like a diver desperate to reach the surface. He opened his eyes and saw a jagged hole blasted through his door. 6 soldiers rushed through the yawning cleft, followed by the 2 Razak, who seemed to fill the room with their ghastly presence. A sword was pressed against Roran's neck. Beside him, Katrina screamed and pulled the blankets around her. Up! Ordered the Razak. Roran cautiously got to his feet. His heart felt like it was about to explode in his chest. Tie his hands and bring him. As a soldier approached Roran with rope, Katrina screamed again and jumped on the men, biting and clawing furiously. Her sharp nails furrowed their faces, drawing streams of blood that blinded the cursing soldiers. Roran dropped to one knee and grabbed his hammer from the floor, then planted his feet, swinging the hammer over his head and roaring like a bear. The soldiers threw themselves at him in an attempt to subdue him through sheer numbers, but to no avail. Katrina was in danger, and he was invincible. Shields crumpled beneath his blows, brigandines and mail split under his merciless weapon, and helmets caved in. 2 men were wounded, and 3 fell to rise no more. The clang and clamour had roused the household. Roran dimly heard Horst and his sons shouting in the hall. The Razak hissed to one another, then scuttled forward and grasped Katrina with inhuman strength, lifting her off the floor as they fled the room. Roran! She shrieked. Summoning his energy, Roran bowled past the 2 remaining men. He stumbled into the hall and saw the Razak climbing out a window. Roran dashed toward them and struck at the last Razak just as it was about to descend below the windowsill. Jerking upward, the Razak caught Roran's wrist in mid-air and chittered with delight, blowing its fetid breath onto his face.
"Yes, you are the one we want."
Roran tried to twist free, but the Razak did not budge. With his free hand, Roran buffeted the creature's head and shoulders, which were as hard as iron. Desperate and enraged, he seized the edge of the Razak's hood and wrenched it back, exposing its features. A hideous, tortured face screamed at him. The skin was shiny black, like a beetle carapace. The head was bald. Each lidless eye was the size of his fist and gleamed like an orb of polished hematite. No iris or pupil existed. In place of a nose, mouth and chin, a thick beak hooked to a sharp point that clacked over a barbed purple tongue. Roran yelled and jammed his heels against the side of the window frame, struggling to free himself from the monstrosity. But the Razak inexorably drew him out of the house. He could see Katrina on the ground, still screaming and fighting. Just as Roran's knees buckled, Horst appeared by his side and wrapped a knotted arm around his chest, locking him in place.
"Someone get a spear!"
shouted the smith. He snarled, veins bulging on his neck from the strain of holding Roran.
"It'll take more than this demon spawn to best us!"
The Razak gave a final yank, then, when it failed to dislodge Roran, cocked its head and said,
"You are ours!"
It lunged forward with blinding speed, and Roran howled as he felt the Razak's beak close on his right shoulder, snipping through the front of the muscle. His wrist cracked at the same time. With a malicious cackle, the Razak released him and fell backward into the night. Horst and Roran sprawled against each other in the hallway.
"They have Katrina," groaned Roran.
His vision flickered and went black around the edges as he pushed himself upright on his left arm. His right hung useless. Olbrych and Baldur emerged from his room, splattered with gore. Only corpses remained behind them.
"Now I have killed 8.
Roran retrieved his hammer and staggered down the hall, finding his way blocked by Elaine in her white sleeping shift. She looked at him with wide eyes, then took his arm and pushed him down onto a wood chest set against the wall.
"You have to see Gertrude, but you'll pass out if this bleeding isn't stopped."
He looked down at his right side. It was drenched in crimson.
"We have to rescue Katrina before..."
He clenched his teeth as the pain surged.
"Before they do anything to her!"
"He's right. We can't wait," said Horst, looming over them. "Bind him up as best you can, then we'll go."
Elaine pursed her lips and hurried to the linen closet. She returned with several rags, which she wrapped tightly around Roran's torn shoulder and his fractured wrist. Meanwhile, Olbrych and Baldur scavenged armour and swords from the soldiers. Horst contented himself with just a spear. Elaine put her hands on Horst's chest and said,
"Be careful."
She looked at her sons.
"All of you."
"We'll be fine, mother," promised Olbrych. She forced a smile and kissed them on the cheek. They left the house and ran to the edge of Carvajal, where they found that the wall of trees had been pulled open and the watchman, Bird, slain. Baldur knelt and examined the body, then said with a choked voice,
"He was stabbed from behind."
Roran barely heard him through the pounding in his ears. Dizzy, he leaned against a house and panted for breath.
"Ho, who goes?"
From their stations along Carvajal's perimeter, the other watchmen congregated around their murdered compatriot, forming a huddle of shuttered lanterns. In hushed tones, Horst described the attack and Katrina's plight.
"Who will help us?" he asked.
After a quick discussion, 5 men agreed to accompany them. The rest would remain to guard the breach in the wall and rouse the villagers. Pushing himself off the house, Roran trotted to the head of the group as it slipped through the fields and down the valley toward the Razak's camp. Every step was agony, yet it did not matter. Nothing mattered except Katrina. He stumbled once, and Horst wordlessly caught him. 1/2 mile from Carvajal, Ivor spotted a sentry on a hillock, which compelled them to make a wide detour. A few 100 yards beyond, the ruddy glow of torches became visible. Roran raised his good arm to slow their advance, then began to dodge and crawl through the tangled grass, startling a jackrabbit. The men followed Roran's lead as he worked his way to the edge of a grove of cattails, where he stopped and parted the curtain.